The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome into episode 13 of the House of L podcast. I am your dutiful host, Lawrence Holmes, here with you. I'm excited for this week's episode as a person who, when I started the podcast, I was like, this is someone that I want to talk to. This is someone that I want to have on the show. And it gives me the opportunity to compare notes and talk across the aisle and all of that good stuff. This week's guest is Sarah Spain, and we'll get to the conversation with Sarah coming up in a little bit. We do have some emails that I'll go through at the end of the episode, and I like that people are emailing the podcast, houseoflpodcast@gmail.com. If you have questions, I'll do my best to try and answer them. For the most part, I would like to keep them to the pod. I know that there are a lot of people who want to ask me questions about Score politics, for example, and I'm not interested in answering them on my podcast. I'll take a couple, but I really don't want to do that. That's not what this was intended to do as far as what this podcast is all about. And I don't plan on that being a central post of this podcast, but I do appreciate the interest. It's just there's not a lot of good that can happen from me talking about some of this stuff. And I would hope that you would understand that, but some people don't for some reason. It's also really interesting that the podcasts that do the best are the ones that some people would consider the most salacious. Like, oh, well, Jason was on. He had things to say. So I thought that the great thing about the episode with Jason was that how heartfelt it was, how emotional it was. But whatever. I'm just doing whatever. Anyway, I want to get to this interview because I think it's really good. It took us a while to figure out whether or not we could actually make it happen because ESPN doesn't ordinarily let their people out all that often to do stuff. So Sarah and I have actually been working, trying to make this happen for about 6 weeks now, because she's got a crazy schedule. I have a crazy schedule. She had to get approval from ESPN. I'm recording the pod at the Score. So I had to get permission from Mitch to have Sarah in the building, you know, all that sort of stuff. But we got it done, and I'm really happy that we did. In this week's pod, you'll hear me talk about the first time that I met Sarah. And one of the reasons why I wanted to have her on the podcast is how much she's grown since my initial meeting with her. Full disclosure, a couple years ago, I had Sarah come speak to my class at DePaul. I was so impressed at what she had become and what she was doing that I wanted her to tell her story to my class. I thought that it would be valuable for the students at DePaul to hear that you don't have to go the traditional route to find yourself in this business. Sarah has proven herself, I think, as a really good journalist, but her way into the business was unorthodox. And I think that more people that want to do this for a living should understand that there are multiple avenues to getting into this business. And then it's a matter of what are you going to do once you get an opportunity, once the door is opened up for you with that opportunity. And I think Sarah is a great example of taking an opportunity at multiple junctures in her career and maximizing it. And I think that her ascension as one of ESPN's most important opinion people is a testament to her understanding how to play the game, when to play the game, and becoming a really important voice for journalism in our business. I think that she's a good check and balance on a medium that is very male. I think it's important, whether it's someone like her or Michelle Beadle or my friend Kristen Balboni over at Stadium, that I'm glad that the industry at least seemingly is opening up to having more women involved in it. Hopefully that's something where we'll see more minorities involved in it as well. So Sarah and I sat down and had a great talk. I think that you're really going to like it. I know I did. Hopefully she did. And that's this week's guest. ESPN's own Sarah Spain. You see her around the horn, the Dan Le Batard Show, her podcast, which is great. That's What She Said. That is the name of her podcast. And all sorts of other stuff that she's done, the trifecta as well. Me and Sarah kicked it here in the studio. I was thinking about, obviously, today, since you were coming in, but I was thinking about you specifically because I was watching the History of Comedy on CNN, and they had done the episode with all of the group stuff and the Groundlings. And I was like, I can talk with Sarah about this.
I haven't seen that one yet.
It's really good.
I've seen a bunch of them. I have to catch that one.
They didn't have my boys, The State, in there, and that was my jam. Like back
in college,
I'm gonna
dip my balls in it.
Absolutely, $240 of pudding. I actually just met Thomas Lennon last week, and he couldn't have been nicer. And I was just sitting there going, "There's so much I want to ask you."
Yeah.
So hopefully at some point he'll be on the podcast. But that was something that you started out in doing. Do you still want to be that person, whether it's improv or doing stand-up or anything like that?
I mean, deep down, I love it, and that's why on my podcast I always have comedians and stand-ups and SNL cast members and whoever I can get my hands on that's in the comedy scene, because there's a side of me that really still wishes that I was doing that. But I also am aware that it's not too late, but it's a little late for me to suddenly make a move into a completely different industry. And my success in this one has allowed me to do some little things throughout, you know, whether it's the fantasy football marathon last year, which was basically 19 hours of costumed improv idiocy, or, you know, rapping on Le Batard Show, or rapping on Spain and Prim, finding ways to get creative and performative on Around the Horn, on the Halloween episode, on the HQ Halloween episode, doing it all in full accent and costume for the whole show. I found ways to be the performer that I always wanted to be in this job. But I also think that I'm self-aware enough to realize that I'm not as inherently built for that as other people are who have found success in it.
Why not?
I think I'm quite funny, but within certain contexts, I don't know that I'm naturally... My brain doesn't naturally work in the way that a comedian does. But on the other hand, if I trained for it...
That's what I was going to say.
Like, I was very successful at improv. I never trained for comedy writing or stand-up, which I would still think would be amazing. So maybe I'm selling myself short, and if I actually trained for it, I would be. But part of what I love about this job now is that I get to combine the performative and comedic stuff when I want to with feeling like I'm making a difference as well. And there are comedians that do that. I mean, you can look at shows like Amy Schumer's, you know, show that have sketches about rape in the military or guns or sexism, like all this stuff.
It's so funny because that was one of the clips that they used. They used like that specific clip from the show where she's playing the video game.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can make a difference, and you can be influential, and you can speak out on issues using comedy. And there's parts of that that I would like to do in sport, even, where it's taking a satirical approach to an issue in sports so that people digest it better, because they're learning and being educated on it, but they're receiving it in a package that's more interesting than a straight, like, Tom Rinaldi feature that's well-researched and reported, but maybe someone's not going to watch it because they think it's too serious. And so I want to get to the people that are not going to watch or listen unless it's got that edge to it. So I think I'm able to combine it in ways that is still validating. Although, I mean, I just had a full Saturday Night Live themed birthday party, so I think that says enough about how much I really still dream of, like, having that life.
Who was your favorite actor on that show?
Eddie Murphy.
Why?
I don't know if it was just it hit at the right age. My parents let me watch Saturday Night Live at an age that was probably inappropriate, to be fair. To be fair, I was staying up late with them when I shouldn't have been. But so then I got into Coming to America and Eddie Murphy Delirious, which is still the greatest stand-up of all time. And then Best of Eddie Murphy SNL, there was a VHS that you could rent at the movie store. And so that was it. It was Buckwheat and Mr. Robinson's Neighborhood and James Brown's Celebrity Hot Tub. And I would walk around the house doing the, "Hi, I'm Velvet Jones. Do you want to be a hoe? You can work from the comforts of your own bedroom." Like, I would pick the most inappropriate ones to repeat repeatedly all the time. And I don't know. I just think Eddie Murphy changed that, saved that show. If you ever read the great book about SNL that James Andrew Miller oral history of SNL. He saved the show. It was going to be gone. And there's so many incredibly talented people, but Eddie Murphy is just my favorite comedian of all time, so he get me there.
Do you want him to pick the microphone back up, or yes. You like, you do? Because I know there are some Eddie Murphy fans.
These kids' movies are not for me. I don't want to watch, I don't even know. I mean, other than Nutty Professor, I don't even know the names of the ones he's doing. I know he's in Shrek.
Shrek, yeah.
But he's done some other, like, no, I want old Eddie Murphy to come back.
So leather jacket, yes. No shirt on Eddie
yes.
Murphy.
Like Dirty Murphy.
Okay.
Yes, that's what I want.
So you're not afraid that if he dips his toe back in, it might not be a great experience?
Actually, that's a really great point, because that's kind of what happened with Chappelle's first stand-up when he came back. He was gone for a while, and the world evolved, and he didn't. And it was tough at times to watch. And then when he let out those two, the Equanimity of Whatever and the Bird, you know, those two that he just did, the first one I thought had showed a little bit of growth from him and an understanding and a reaction to the previous set that had been kind of criticized. And the second one was him trying to address a bunch of Me Too stuff that he was just not educated enough on and was on the wrong side of, and basically evolved into him calling women weak for not being able to handle it.
It felt like he was trying to work through it in the set.
Yes, and it didn't work for the room. There was a lot of uncomfortable people in that room. And then as a viewer, to me, and it wasn't he's pushing it and he's going to the edge. It wasn't that. It was he has not fully thought these things out, and he's defensive and antiquated in his opinions on it. So you're right. There's absolutely a part of me that might not be able to find and place Eddie Murphy in today's world. But I would like to think he's such a talented comedian that he would be able to still make us laugh. But, I mean, the rules are different. And I don't think that's a bad thing.
What drew you to improv overall?
You know, when I moved to L.A. right after college, I came back to Chicago for a couple months to save money. And then I moved to L.A. wanting to do comedy or like TV hosting. Like, my dream jobs were SNL and like hosting Talk Soup back when it was like Greg Kinnear days, right? And I ended up doing a TV hosting boot camp, which was like just a weekend long where you learn intros, outros, opens,
where?
Camera presence. It was this woman, Marky. Oh, I'm gonna forget her last name, but she's legitimately been on a bunch of TV shows now. They bring her in as like the coach.
A consultant. Okay.
Yeah. So she's known around Hollywood. It was when I was living in LA. And I didn't know, she was like, "What are you guys experts in?" Everybody was like interior design, or it was like right before the HGTV boom. It was right around the beginning of that. So everybody was an expert in that. And I was like, I don't know. I'm not an expert in pop culture, Hollywood stuff, because I didn't really want to do E. But I'm not an expert in anything that would be for TV. Like, I'm not going to say literature. I was an English major, right? So I did a Chicago Bears show. I was like, oh, I'm sports, you know, like, I'll just use this for this exercise we're doing. And she said, oh, you want to be a sports host? I said, oh, no, there's no women in sports, and they don't get to be funny. And she was like, well, maybe you could be. I was like, And then in that boot camp, she suggested everyone do improv. She was like, it'll help you with hosting. You'll be like quick on the fly. You'll have, you know, great witty responses. You'll be able to work with any partner. And so I went to do the improv stuff right around the same time as I thought to myself, maybe I dip my toe in the sports waters and see if I can combine my love of comedy with my love of sports and not try to follow a path that I already see. Because there were no Michelle Beatles. There was no Katie Nolan. There was no, it was a very serious anchor, or it was a very bubbly sidelines reporter that got 2 minutes and didn't get to have a personality. And I didn't see myself in anybody. And that whole, if you can see it, you can be it thing is absolutely true. I didn't feel like I couldn't do sports. It just literally never occurred to me. I spent my life watching Michael Jordan and the Bulls.
And loving Michael Jordan.
And there wasn't a single woman that I saw on TV talking about it or covered it or talked on the radio about it, or it just wasn't. I'm sure that back then there were probably a handful of women writing, but when I was that age, I wasn't checking bylines. I was never into the media. I was into the sports.
Mm.
So the media never occurred to me.
So you're not looking at like a Tony Jannetty story and being like, oh, I can be Tony Jannetty.
Totally. Never was my interest because it didn't even occur to me that first of all, my parents are not into sports. So they weren't like talking to me about it. We weren't talking about the Bulls games and who they were playing next and go read this story and whatever else. I was just consuming the parts of it that I liked. And so it wasn't until later when I took a class at UCLA Extension that was for, you know, non-attendees in TV sports reporting. That was my first taste of like, oh, wait, this is my wheelhouse. I've been an athlete my whole life, all through college. I've been a fan my whole life. And it was going to take a monumental amount of work to become a person who works in that business as opposed to someone who casually watches, because I had to learn every sport that I didn't watch, and I had to learn the sports that I did watch in a way that I hadn't watched them before. It wasn't just about sitting and having a beer and watching a football game. It was what are the rules and what are the expectations from each team and at each moment and decision and strategy and everything. But once I went to that class, I was like, I should have been doing this all along.
How would you recommend that someone take that jump? Because it's one of the hardest things that I have to do with my students is to teach them how to watch a game. So how do you think you watched games differently after that point?
Well, I had the best job for that. It was perfect because one of the people who came to speak at the UCLA class was this guy, Rick Jaffe. He was one of the higher ups at Fox Sports. So everyone would put their email on the board. I messaged Rich Eisen's wife, went over to their house and had wine and had her give me suggestions because she worked in the biz, Susie Schuster. I messaged the guy who was calling the Kings games to ask about his job. Messaged Rick Jaffe. I said, can I please take you to lunch? I want to talk to you about like getting into the business. And he had said we could all come and see a live taping of a show if we wanted. So went, saw the show, took him to lunch. And there was a nightly highlight show called The Final Score. And it ran on East Coast, Colorado, West Coast every night. And it was a half hour. It was Andrew Siciliano was one of the hosts, Danielle Sargent. There was a handful of different hosts. And I became a PA. That was my first job in sports. I had done a job here at Intersport, actually.
I remember that.
As like an intern. That was just a random connection that I had through Cornell. I didn't want to work in sports. It was just that the woman knew I was an athlete and was like, hey, you could work here while you're saving money to move. So this was my first intentional job in sports. And I was logging games. So I would get in around 1 o'clock. And I would log usually like a 3 o'clock game that was 7 o'clock or a 4 o'clock game that was 7 o'clock in New York, baseball or whatever it was. And I would have to sit and write down the game as it went and then later type and then pick the highlights and write what the anchor person would say. So they would say, all right, you got 30 seconds for this Bulls Timberwolves. So I would be watching the game and I would be writing down not every play, not if it was a steal that wasn't miraculous. It was a great play, every score, every whatever. And so then you have to learn exactly what happened. In fact, it's embarrassing to admit, but when I started logging football, I would write punt for everything, not kickoff. I would always call it a punt. I just was like, okay, it's going back to the other team. It's a punt, even when it was a kickoff. And I didn't know the difference. I had, you know, my parents didn't watch football. I didn't start watching football until I was midway through high school. And then I'm just sitting by myself watching the game kind of halfway while I'm reading or doing whatever else. I'm not interacting with everyone about what's going on in the game. So it wasn't until later in life that I was like, I can choose these things to spend my time doing and going to. So the sports I played and then the Bulls and stuff, I was all into. It wasn't until later that I was like, oh, I can choose to go to a baseball game or a football game or watch this. And so I had a lot to learn, and the logging was huge. NASCAR, golf, hockey, every sport. Not only do you have to watch it, but you have to sit and know what you're writing. What was that? Oh, well, that was offsides. That was, you know, whatever kind of penalty.
That was an eagle on 16
exactly.
or whatever it was.
Yeah, or NASCAR. That one didn't have to do a lot. It was crashes and winners. But I at least figured out what drafting was, kind of. But yeah, and that's terrifying, especially as a woman, because there are people who are in that room that have been watching in a different way their whole lives. And you can let it just tell you that you're not going to make it, or you can say, okay, I'm gonna learn this and I'm going to turn it into a job instead of just being a fan.
I remember when I first met you. I don't know if you remember. It was probably more memorable for me than for you. We were at a Charles Tillman flag football
yes.
game. And you were squiring an intern. And you said, you know, I had introduced myself. And you were like, oh, you know, I know you. And I like what you do. And I was saying how, you know, the intern should listen to you and should listen mm-hmm. to Bruce. Because Bruce was over there and JD at the time. And I remembered you being... I remembered like hearing your voice and like, man, she's got a great voice for radio. And I felt that you were still like a little unsure
sure
of yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
And I couldn't understand why, because I'm like, here she is. She's got this big voice. Like, yeah. this is going to work out for yeah. her, but she seems like unsure about where she is.
That was my first on-camera job. That was Mouthpiece Sports, which I moved back to Chicago for. It was like a startup website. I was writing. I was working on camera. I was in the locker rooms doing beat reporter type stuff for the Blackhawks and the Cubs and going to events like that. And that job I actually, when I interviewed for, told them I was going to bring my improv into. And that's a good example, that Peanut Tillman one. Instead of doing an interview, hey, what's the cause? How nice does it feel that your teammates came out to support you? That kind of thing. I instead mic'd myself up, said I was trying out to be the wide receiver for the Bears. Because at that point, Devin Hester, sadly enough, was their number one. And they didn't have like a real good depth chart idea yet of who was going to be their number two receiver. So I had him throw me passes and basically talk smack about how bad I was. And that was the piece. And that was more interesting to me that people would want to watch than another boring interview. Same thing with the Cubs. I would go in and after Zambrano destroyed the clubhouse Gatorade cooler, I did a whole story about how the cooler went on the DL. And they weren't sure when the hydration would be back. And I interviewed all the players about losing a guy that's so, you know, important to their everyday success. So stuff like that. And that was me bringing my background of comedy in. And also that job was great because it wasn't about knowing the nitty gritty and being able to talk about what it means when this player is out for a week or this hockey guy's got a lower body injury. What does this mean for the line changes? I wouldn't have known that then. I just started. So I was bringing the comedy to the job I was doing, which was about bringing out player personalities and telling stories. And over time, my knowledge grew, my confidence grew, and the different roles I've had have meant that I've needed to have different skill sets.
From a journalistic standpoint, and I'm not saying this because you're sitting in front of me, the growth that you've shown is unbelievable. Like from that moment to you being a Peabody Award winner because of some of the stuff that you're doing. But I'd love to know, how was there a moment where it clicked and you're like, I've got this. Like I found my lane on how I can be impactful in what I do.
Well, there's two of them. So the feeling comfortable thing actually, I mean, I've managed to understand my limitations in a lot of places so that I don't feel uncomfortable because I don't overstep, right? If I don't know something, I'm more likely to admit it, even though as a woman that's tougher, right? As a guy, you can get stuff wrong all the time and people give you the benefit of the doubt as soon as you mess up as well. Oh, you shouldn't have your job. But working with Dan Le Batard has really helped me. He's one of my mentors. And if you listen to his show, he doesn't take himself too seriously. He's incredibly knowledgeable, but midway through a show, somehow randomly, the New York Nets will come up and he'll be like, does anyone in here know the coach of the Nets? Anyone. And he'll reveal that you can't know everything. Even someone like him who's so knowledgeable, who's going to pull some name from 1990s baseball that I've never even heard of and give me a half hour on it or tell me great social issue commentary, whatever it is. He can't know everything. And that's the pressure of this job, right? Is that Every day there's a new piece of news. Every day there's a new player you need to know. And people expect you to also know about players from the 60s, 70s, 80s, whatever. So his freedom in being able to say, I don't know everything at his position made me feel more free to say, I'm not doing every role at the company. I don't need to be as up to football as Adam Schefter and as knowledgeable about basketball as Jalen Rose and whatever else. I just need to do my stuff well, and I need to be good at what I do for why people want to come to my radio show, read my stories, listen to my podcast, whatever it is. And then I think also as far as being impactful, I think most women in this industry have a pivot point, and I call it the pivot, where you have to play the game for long enough that you can then change it. You need to be the person that guys want to grab a beer with and talk smack with and have fun with and feel like you're part of the group. And then at some point you get the agency and the voice where you can say, I'm going to alienate some people who no longer want to grab a beer with me because I'm going to say things that need to be said about how we cover stuff, how we treat women, how we talk about women athletes, how we interact with people in the workplace. And that's going to help change it for other people. And it is going to be impactful, even if it doesn't serve me in terms of just straight popularity. And some women never make that pivot. Some would rather continue to be as popular and successful as they can, even in the face of continuing or ignoring issues that are around them. For me, it was only a couple years into working at even ESPN 1000 that I was like, instead of just laughing when there's a joke that I think shouldn't be told, I'm going to turn my mic on and say something.
What was the hardest part of the pivot?
When you're still trying to make it, you don't like to know that people are disliking what you're doing. And being a spoil sport has never been my thing. I have a great sense of humor. I'm usually the one pushing the envelope, but
you're also pretty good at making fun of yourself.
Yeah. So it's not that I'm a spoil sport or I'm a wet blanket. And that frustrates me now, even when people still think that I wish you had a sense. I'm like, you have no idea. I just also know where I want to draw a line because I think it matters, right? And so that sucked because I was still, I mean, I felt for me at the time, I was like, I can't believe I'm on the radio for ESPN. This is amazing. But I was an update anchor. I didn't have my own show. I was writing for ESPNW. And I had, this was before Around the Horn, this was before SportsCenter, this was before having my own show. And so I felt like I had made it, but I hadn't. I still had a ways to go. And so to be in that position and be deciding that you're okay with some people turning off to you because they don't like that you're making them face realities, that was tough to do. But I also felt like for who I am and who I've always been in my life, it would not have worked to be disingenuous about stuff that matters to me.
I listened to your podcast, That's What She Said, is the name of the podcast. The episode you did with other women in the business, it was striking, a lot of this stuff. Now, I known some of the stories because I had worked with some of the women that you had on the show. Rebecca Harlow and I used to do Sports Sunday together, so it's always great to hear her point of view on things, especially when she was talking about the dressing room and the makeup room. It's really fascinating, and I've learned that now, like working in TV, especially since I don't have any hair anymore, like I can be done in 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, whether it's Rebecca or Laura Britt, who I used to work with, they're getting there an hour before. And I'm like, why? And like, oh, because if they don't look.
Yeah. But that sucks, too, because I don't want someone not to hire me because then they're like, oh, we got to get hair and makeup, or because it's going to take longer, or when you come in, we need to give X amount of time. That's BS. But also, I can't go on the air and just throw on a t-shirt and do no makeup because we are held to different standards and expectations. In fact, I already push back on the BS enough by just deciding that there's an X amount of time in my life that I want to spend to what I look like. And I'm going to do it because of my job and also just some natural human desire to not look bad, right? Everybody wants to look their best. But I refuse to be so obsessed with it that I don't devote that time to reading or hanging out with my friends and family.
Or sleeping.
Or doing the prep for my job that I need. If I'm at the nail salon and getting a facial and getting a wax and getting things plucked and getting things dyed and getting things Botox, and the amount of time you could spend trying to chase this ideal when you should be just prepping for the job is frustrating. And so I hope to never lose my job because I don't look good enough. But I also refuse to like waste my life spending all of my time trying to look like someone that I'm not going to ever look like anyway.
How do you handle criticism of your looks?
It was a lot harder when I started because I was insecure about them and because there was, you grow a thick skin over time. So when you first, I was at Mouthpiece Sports and there would be comments on like a video, like, are you fat or do you just look, are you pregnant or do you just look fat? Or that shirt looks awful on you or this is a bad choice or whatever. And I still get those messages all the time. It's just I'm so used to them by now that I don't care. You know, every once in a while someone says something that I'm like, oh, that hurts my feelings. But what are you going to do? Like, what kind of person is messaging somebody to say, you look fat? Or some guy just messaged me and he was like, no offense, but who picks your outfits for TV? And then I looked and the only other time he had messaged me was exactly like a year and a half before. And he just wrote, interesting outfit today. So I'm like, what kind of person is that their way of interacting with a complete stranger? And how were they raised and how do they feel about themselves, right? If you feel good about yourself, all you want to do is lift other people up, right? If you feel bad about yourself, you want to take other people down to make you feel better. So anybody who's coming at me with that is probably pretty dissatisfied. And then I feel bad for them. I'm not angry with them. I feel sad that that's what they think about life. Also, you get one body, you get one face, you get one set of genes. And if you spend your whole life being sad about what you could have had instead, it's not going to change. I'm not going to look like, I don't know, who's great? Blake Lively is pretty hot, although she got a nose job. So I guess I could get a nose job and that would get me one step closer. But you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't, at some point in your life, you decide, of course you care what you look like. You're going to do your best. But if you spend all your time wishing you look differently, you're just wasting your time. It's not going to change.
Does it ever bother the people around you? Like, how much do you let them?
Oh, my God. My friends and family are like, how do you do your job?
Yeah.
Like, we could not take this. And I always say it's about the slow growing of thick skin. Yeah. If tomorrow, all of a sudden, your entire social media timeline was filled with people telling that you're fat and ugly and you sound like a dude or whatever else, you would be pretty upset. But if it started with a small amount of people when you were on a tiny website, and then you got on local radio, and then you got on national radio, and then you got on TV. By the time you get there, it's not that you want people to be mean to you, but you go, cool, great, mute, block, move on.
Yeah, that's...
And also, I'm not going to let those people live in my head. What does it serve me to say, you, stranger, who I would never talk to in person, and if I was, you would never say this, I'm going to let you make me feel bad, I'm going to let my day be changed by you saying I look fat?
I feel like some of those people, if they were to ever see you in person, like their approach would be...
Yeah, they are super nice. I have had almost zero people approach me in public. I have had one person who is actually the sibling of someone at the radio station I used to work for be like, yeah, you know, I thought you really sucked at first, but you're getting better. I'm like, cool, thank you. That is literally the meanest thing anyone said to me in person. And then one fan of a website that I do not like in person saw me and made some comment about how I suck. And other than that, it's just that doesn't happen because you don't interact with people in person that way. For the most part, right? Unless you're in a drunk bar fight or it's someone that you know that you have a beef with. You don't tell a stranger in person that you hate them or they're ugly or you don't like their work.
Because there could be consequences.
Yes.
To doing that.
And also because there's actual scientific research that backs up that when you interact with someone in person, you have psychosomatic responses to what they show you, what their eyes are telling you, what their face is doing, the way their eyebrows are moving, the way their voice changes. You understand physically, your body understands physically how you're affecting someone else. It doesn't happen online because you can't see them, you can't hear them, you don't know anything about them. And so our bodies actually, for the most part, seek out points of
connection.
Seek out ways to make good on a conversation with someone, not ways to make it worse, because you're watching them react to what you're saying. And if you're hurting their feelings or if you're making them sad or if you're making them angry, we don't have any connection points online. So we just blow past all of the stop signs we would be getting and we're awful to people.
How do you handle social media at this point? Because there are times where I'm just like, I've completely pretty much divorced from Facebook.
Yeah.
Like, other than...
I mean, we all should. No, based on what we know about it
now,
but it's tough. It's a great connector for friends
and fans and everything else. But I've for the most part, I will comment on friends and family's posts, and I'll post like the podcast or when the next show is coming up. But that's pretty much it.
What about like Twitter and Instagram? And
Instagram, I'm probably more personal than anywhere on Instagram. Like there's pictures of me and Mel. There's, you know, pictures of my nieces and nephews, like that sort of thing. Pictures of my mom. Twitter, I've gotten to the point now where I kind of like to play around now on Twitter where it's like, you know, I'll comment on your stuff and it'll be a GIF. You know, like that's
you're a GIF guy, huh?
I love it.
I'm a GIF gal.
Well, okay.
No, I love GIFs, GIFs. And I know that the guy who created them says it's GIF. But I don't care because we all decided it was GIF long ago and we should have stuck with it.
GIF.
It's like Alice and Alexei Ramirez.
Yeah, but we don't say
Lassier.
Like, we say laser.
Okay, I'm saying we never started saying Lassier. We started saying GIF. It's a made-up word. It's a thing that we all decided was GIF, and so we shouldn't change it to GIF.
Just like White Sox. Like, White Sox with the next is both singular and plural because it's a made-up word.
Right.
So you can say such and such was a White Sox or...
A White Sox.
No, don't say a White Sox. It's got to be a White Sox or else Hawk Harrelson is going to get really mad, I think. But I've become more personal probably on Instagram. Twitter, I just kind of, I use it, but there are times where I'm like, that's enough. Like, uninstall the app thing.
Right, I'm getting better at stepping away. I go through times where I'm really good about it, and I step away. And then I end up using a lot. Like, I have to be careful because we have company guidelines that are ever-changing, that are hard to truly understand. I don't blame them for their attempts to corral us and rein in what we discuss. I don't blame me and anybody else for feeling like we have things that we want to say. It's a complicated time for that. And so sometimes I do need to step away because I get too wrapped up in it. I find the biggest problem I have is when I'm traveling. So in May and June, I had 21 flights. And and so I'm in a hotel room or I'm sitting at the airport or I'm on a flight or I'm whatever. I don't have a choice to interact with friends and family. Yes, I do bring books or listen to podcasts. But for that 20 minutes when you're waiting, you don't pull the book out. Or when you're sitting in bed watching TV in a hotel, you don't have a DVR to change what you want to watch. That's when I get stuck where I'm like using it too much because I don't really have anything else to do. And I'm sitting, I'm just interacting with people. When I'm home and having fun and I have a life, I don't get drawn into it as often. But it's a choice. And I think it can be a super useful tool. And I think it can be a great way to point out beliefs and opinions that are really wrong and speak back to them. And are you going to change that person? Probably not. But there's probably a lot of other people watching and listening and paying attention that are thinking a little differently because of the way you present things and the way you talk about them. And then there's all these people like, oh, don't feed the trolls. Why do you give them attention? And I'm like, I'm not going to digest it all day long and never clap back. Sometimes it's for fun. Sometimes they set themselves up for a giant burn, and I want to feel the satisfaction of that. Sometimes I want to point out that this is crap that we still have to deal with in 2018. Sometimes I see the same thing over and over, and I pick one of them, and I'll respond to it because I want people to see this point of view that's unfortunately still way too common. So I really pick my battles. Most people have no idea how many people I just mute and block and never wrote me. And then I pick the ones I want to engage with.
Recently, you kind of went through a thing with Britt McHenry on Twitter. When it's someone that you worked with, I don't know if you guys were ever even around each other, but that seems like, and I've had a couple of these too, where it's like, really? Like, we're going to do this?
I didn't want to do that, and I shouldn't have. And I have never worked with her. I don't think I've ever spoken to her. I think we were in one big event classroom thing, and I might have introduced myself, and that's it. But I don't remember ever interacting with her. She was attacking or degrading ESPNW as a less-than platform, and that she never would have written for it because she wanted to be on par with the guys. Completely misunderstanding how the platform works and the website and what it stands for and what it represents. So my response to her was not a personal shot. It was about the website and in defense of the website. I shouldn't have even engaged because not everybody interacts the same way on Twitter. And the way it ended up was not what I would have wanted or how I would want to carry myself. Even if I was provoked into being a person that I don't want to be, I still shouldn't be that way. But if you see me, I don't attack people. I don't take cheap shots. When someone's in my timeline and insults me, I don't go look at their avatar and find something to insult about them. I think that's crappy. That's doing the exact same thing they do. And I see really smart and successful people doing that, right? They'll say, oh, you would know with all your chins. And I'm like, what are you doing? Like, I don't do that to people. That's not how I operate in life or online. You could be really mean to me, and I'm going to make fun of your grammar or your spelling, or I'm going to make fun of your terrible, antiquated ideas, but I'm not going to say you're fat or ugly or whatever. You live in your mom's basement. I mean, it's stupid. So, something like that is end of a midway through all those trips, too, where I just get stuck on there and I'm on it too much.
No, I get it. I looked at my battery usage the other day, and it was telling me, like, how much time I spent on Twitter. I was like, oh.
Yeah.
That is.
Well, do you watch Hard Knocks?
I do.
Okay, did you see the guy that was showing them all the different ways to save money?
Nassib, yeah.
And so at the end of the episode, in, like, the little tidbit, he's telling them, if you spend 10% of your day on Instagram, you've essentially now given, you know.
Was it a month?
A month, yeah.
A month of your year away.
Yeah. Whatever the calculus was. I hate math. But and then you're like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's probably too much time.
Yeah, I don't like that.
It's very, very. Let's talk about, we've been getting serious. Let's go back to something fun. I'm a fan of the Levitard show, too.
Yeah.
I love when you pop up on there. I love when Mina pops up on there. It seems like a great time. Is it as fun as it looks?
Yes. It's super fun. They've created this.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Massive playpen full of different personalities, and they found ways to pull out of each of the people in there their own special, unique weirdness, and they embrace the weirdness. When I first went to do it, I had not been listening to the show that often, so I got there and I'm like, what's the club? What's happening, right? And I was expecting and hoping for a rundown, because there's always that fear of what if they start talking about a topic I don't know anything about. And they don't use rundowns. They'll ask you if you have stuff you want to talk about, and he'll try to bring it up during the show so that you can chat about whatever topic you're interested in. But you just got to go with the flow on anything, any topic that comes up. And that might be something that's in the news that day, and it might be 90s baseball, and it might be, do you stand or sit when you're wiping? That's an actual topic.
I remember that.
So that's my kind of show, because that's the improv kicking in. That's, you can play with anything. So I love being down there, and it is, I don't know if you read the Slate article about it that, was actually written by Moe's from The Office, who also created Parks and Rec and Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
I didn't know it was the same person.
Yeah. I didn't know that either. I talked to him for a full hour for that interview, for that story, and then later found out it was him.
He
just came on my podcast a couple weeks ago. He's awesome.
But wow.
Yeah. Michael Schur. He created Brooklyn Nine-Nine, The Good Place, Parks and Rec. He's Moe's from The Office. He wrote an episode of Black Mirror. He's all over the place. But he's Ken Tremendous on Twitter. He was one of the people who started Fire Joe Morgan.
Oh, man.
And he wrote for The Office and Saturday Night Live. And
I am learning a lot today.
Yeah, but anyway, he just loves the Levitard show so much that he wrote that story about it.
Well, I think that they're on to something. And I know that, you know, people sometimes bristle at the concept of corporate culture, especially at ESPN. There are a lot of people who want ESPN to fail, which I think is a little weird.
Super weird, because they still watch it all the time.
All the time.
And if ESPN were to fail, it'd be real bad news for every other sports outlet. So
yeah.
You don't want sports to be a big thing. You don't want good coverage.
It's a strange, it's a really strange phenomenon that, and when you started to see layoffs happening at ESPN, one of my reactions was, this is bad. Like, this is bad for the entire industry. Mm-hmm. I don't think that the layoffs at Fox, which were almost as abundant, were covered nearly the same way. But that's another story for another day. What I always find fascinating about the Le Batard show is, here's a show that is its own thing. There's a freedom. And how do you duplicate allowing people to be free? Like, are you allowed on your show to be that free?
I think it's complicated. I think part of the magic there is that Dan makes it feel and look so easy that when other people try to do it, it crashes and burns, because it's not easy to be free-flowing and funny and clever. And you need those apparatus that they have, right? You need Mike to be this incredible producer that always knows when to bring back a piece of sound or a commentary. You need Stu Gotts to play the foil. I've done a bunch of radio shows where early on, or even if it's just with a co-host or a fill-in, the idea is, oh, let's fly by the seat of our pants. Mm-hmm. We don't like rundowns. And then it's not a good listen, because they've got something that they've had for years, decade plus, and they've got all the other pieces that fill in when something drops or when it's not as good. That's almost impossible to do with, like, two people, right? And so I have enough freedom to make choices and do weird things. We do segments that are not straight what you'd expect out of, like, a sports show. But I try to stay within what makes sense for a show where my co-host is across the country and my producer's across the country and I'm here. We're not in a room together. We don't have a bunch of characters that people recognize. We don't have a TV element that's visual.
You don't have the element of nonverbal communication.
Yeah.
Break that down for me. For someone who's listening and going, oh, well, you know, you're ESPN. They might not realize you're not in the same room. And you had multiple co-hosts that were kind of positioned about the country.
The trifecta at times was three different places plus a producer in Connecticut. Yeah.
So how difficult is that to navigate?
I think if you have a good rapport and chemistry with the person, it's not tough. Fitz, my co-host, Spain and Fitz, I think we've got a good chemistry and rapport, so we can bounce off each other. We actually had cameras set up on our computers to look at each other for a while, and we haven't really used them as much because we don't really feel like we need them. I think it is a better product when we're together, inevitably. But nobody seems to notice. Someone the other day was like, we were apart. They knew we were apart for a week for something else. And the person was like, you guys haven't been together in forever. I'm like, we're never together. You just think we are. I'm in the studio in my house in Chicago, and he's in Connecticut with our producer and board op. So at least it helps that they're in the same room versus I've done ones with my old co-host. Izzy was in Miami. Our producer was in Connecticut, and I was in Chicago.
Jeez.
The trifecta was me in Chicago, Jane in Connecticut, Kate in New York usually. But it's about cadence and understanding how someone operates, right? I like to jump in with quick asides and jokes and then pull back and let you finish. So if you think when I jump in, you're done and you just stop, then and there's awkward pauses, right? So that needs to be established is, I'm going to jump in, I'm going to make a joke at your expense, I'm jump back out and let you finish. It's always better to be in person, but a couple of years ago, I decided that I was going to make decisions in my life based on what would actually make me happier, not on what would make me richer or more famous, because I don't think that's the same thing.
That's a hard lesson to learn.
Right.
What drove that?
Well, part of it was I saw colleagues who were out in Connecticut who had significant others in other places and who every chance they got, it would be like, all right, I have 3 days off vacation, and they would fly somewhere immediately. They would be available every second for any job because where they live is just that company. And I would see people who kept taking bigger jobs for more money but not enjoying them as much. And for me, I work really hard and I work a lot, but when I'm done, I have all my friends and family are in this area. I have my teams Like, that was part of it, too, was I'm going to work in sports and I'm going to go to my teams. I don't want to be that person that everybody becomes where they say, oh, well, when you've been in the business long enough, you're just not really a fan the same way anymore.
I'm that person now.
Are you? See, I have a couple of exceptions. I'm a changed fan. I view things differently, but I am no less. I mean, Cubs World Series, I'm bawling and crying and it's hitting me in every single feel. Blackhawks went, like, you know, my teams mean a lot to me still. I'm a massive fan of my teams, even as someone in the industry. I am not the person who's lost that altogether. Like, I kind of would joke with the guys at ESPN 1000 because they talk trash about the tailgating at Soldier Field, and I'd be like, when was the last time you were at a game? And it'd be like 8 or 9 years. I'm like, you don't even know. You're not even there.
Being embedded with the Bears for as long as I was. So I was... I started, 2003, and then I guess I technically stopped covering the beat every day in 2010 or 2011. It was just gone. Like, my whole Bears thing. Yeah, it does. Now, I do make up for it in other ways. I am a stupid DePaul fan, yeah. And pretty much anyone who's a DePaul fan at this point is stupid.
I was going to say... How is it even possible to be a fan of that?
It hasn't been great. It really hasn't. But that's my alma mater. That's where I teach.
That's like trying to go Oppo. That's like basically.
You're right.
Let me see the thing that's least likely and easy to be a fan of.
You're absolutely right, and I deal with it in a lot of weird ways. Like, I used to doing the games, I would get so frustrated after losses that I would go home and bake cookies because I needed to. Relax, and I needed something good to come out of the night. So there'd be some nice warm cookies at the end of a lot of DePaul losses. I'm still pretty crazy about DePaul.
Yeah.
I would say I'm fairly crazy about the White Sox, although I cried when they won the World Series. Yeah. Like, I bawled. Like, yeah. I bawled. I had a little bottle of Vouv. Yeah. And
Which,
I straight
by the way,
up,
to me, is one of those things that's always crazy. Somebody wins every year. It's not Haley's Comet. It's not something that's so rare. I know your team doesn't win every year, but that's why I think it's so funny to me, even when I have these emotions, to know that a team wins every single year, but when it's your team, it matters as much as
no,
it does.
No, but for our two baseball teams.
For the Cubs, of course.
And it had been 88 years for the White Sox. So.
Right. And, like, to be a part of something. I was at every game of the World Series, and what was great was all the home ones, I got to balance being a fan and covering it. So I would do pregame and postgame for SportsCenter and get to be the voice of Chicago and then go in and be a fan and sit in a regular seat with my husband.
That's dope.
And then in Cleveland, we had already gotten these awesome suites through a friend that were, it was still like 700, 800 a game, but that was like 1500 for a standing room. So 800 for a suite where you got all you can eat and drink. So we drove out to Cleveland. We came back. We drove back out for 6 and 7. And I got to be a fan. And, you know, I'm sitting there as Raja Davis hits the homer. And it looks like we're going to blow it. And I'm thinking to myself, of all of the worst things that ever happened to Cubs fans, who are the most tortured fan base in the history of sports, this would be the worst. And I would become one of those people that is a part of the story of the worst things that have ever happened to the saddest team in the history. I'm like, how am I going to have to be bearing witness to yet another of the saddest things that have ever happened to the saddest team?
In a tragic way. It would have been tragic.
That's what I'm saying. It would have been the worst one yet. It would be worse than Bartman. It would be worse than the Black Cat. It would be worse than every curse that's ever happened. Game 7, when you've got a lead like that with stupid freaking Aroldis Chapman, who I didn't even want on the team, to Raja Davis, I would have been distraught. And so... there was a part of me that also in writing all the stories I did that year and in doing all the reporting I did, it just built it up even more for me to understand how lucky those of us who were fans and got to attend and got to witness it were because of all the people that came before that never made it, right? And so you're hearing about all the people who drove out and listened on a radio with their dad's gravestone or who, you know, stuff like that. And that's when you're like, okay, it doesn't matter that it happens every year. This didn't happen every year. This hasn't happened in 108, and it's like it means something. And so I'm really glad I can still be that person, and I don't want to be in an industry where I keep taking money and fame. I lose my connection to my teams, and I'm not happy. I don't go in and think I'm lucky to do this. I go in and think, oh, I don't want stuff like, you know, the get up. I wasn't in the running necessarily, because before I could have even gotten there, when they asked me about it, I said, no, I don't want to live in New York, and I don't want to go to bed at 8 p.m. every night and wake up at 2. I don't, that's not, that would not make me happy, even if you paid me millions of dollars.
So even though it's maybe less prestige and less money, that added value of being able to go see the Blackhawks or the Bulls or go see the Cubs on a regular basis was worth it to you.
Yeah, and see my friends and see my family all the time and be done with work when I'm done. I mean, I work, if I do Around the Horn, which I did today, I don't have my show tonight, that's why I'm here. But if I did, when I do Around the Horn, I start with a 9:30 call. I eat breakfast, I go to makeup, I do the show, I'm done around 2:30. I have 1 hour to get home, eat lunch, get to my radio by 3:30. 3:30 to 8, I'm done at 8. So now I've worked from 9:30 in the morning till 8 p.m. with 1 hour to get home and eat lunch. I don't do that every day. I only do it twice a week. But then I'm done. Then I'm done and I'm home in my studio.
And you're in Chicago, yeah.
And I eat dinner with my husband after my show last night, 8 p.m. We walk the dogs down the street. We go out to dinner. It's a late dinner outside. We enjoy the summer. You know what I'm saying? So, like, I can work as many hours as I do and as weird of hours as I do and then snap my fingers and I'm done. I'm not in Bristol where all my friends are across the country. I can see my parents on a random night in the middle of the week if they're willing to do a late dinner. And that, to me, like, I don't know. It's probably in some ways naive about the length of this industry and how much time I have to be in it. It's probably a little conceited to say, I think I'll find something to do. If people say, even though we never liked you because you're hot, we're still old now and so we don't want you on TV. And I'll be like, shit, that's why I was trying to write and do radio so that you couldn't just kick me out as soon as I got old. But if that happens, then I think, okay, I could go do TV and talk about other issues. I could keep writing. And that's my hope. And I don't know, maybe that's naive, but I don't want to do the thing where I push, and then I'm 50, and I'm like, oh, I'm so glad I have all this money, but now all my friends have a bunch of kids. Nobody does anything anymore. You know what I mean? I like to do everything now so that I don't look back and say, oh, that was a good time for me to have been hanging with my friends and traveling. And
I think that you've got it right. I was having a conversation with a friend of mine who's a producer over at Channel 9. We were talking about this yesterday. It used to be, and I'm a bit of a planner. Like, I'm big into, here's what I want to do in 2 years, in 5 years, okay, in 10 years. I'm that guy.
I'm a control freak now. I'm less of a long-term thinker.
Well, the thing is that I think that you're right. The way that the industry is changing, the way the technology is changing, I think that having a five-year plan is ridiculous. Like, the more I think about it, it's like, it's really crazy. And Mike Hall had been on the podcast a few episodes ago, and he said, when I was working at ESPN, there was no Big Ten Network. I never knew that I was going to be able to come back home and do this.
Same with my friend Bill. He was working out in Connecticut, wanted to move back to this area, came to work for Big Ten Network. It gave him the job he wanted and the place he wanted that before that he never would have known existed.
Yep. I mean, there is a long-term plan for there's something outside of the industry that I want to do. And I know that when I'm done with the industry or the industry is done with me, I'll be in a position to do that. But trying to project, which has been a big portion of my career, it's like, oh, I'm going to do this, and this. I don't think you can do that anymore. I think that if you're looking more than 2 years out on anything in this business, you're insane.
Agreed. I think some things will remain because the industry doesn't turn over that fast. I think TV is one of them, right? We do know that a la carte is changing things and streaming is changing things and digital is changing things. But I don't think there's a time in the near future where TV is just gone.
Right.
The way we watch it, sure. And there will be way more competition and there might not be as much money in it and you might not have the same sponsorships for just straight terrestrial TV as you would have before. But it'll still be there, right? And so I think that stuff you can depend on because otherwise you can also scare yourself out of doing anything. Well, this doesn't even exist anymore. I don't even know what's going to happen. And I'm going to, you know, get off my lawn. So I think you have to be able to adapt and then expect some things to remain so that you don't totally freak out.
By the way, can I just tell you that I absolutely adore your husband? I adore him. I just think that he's great.
So do I. What a coincidence.
Well, I didn't want to marry him, but
too late, taken. Yeah,
he is already taken, but he is great. How your relationship with him, did it help that he was kind of around the business?
Yes, so much so. Yeah, when I met him, he'd been working for StubHub for a number of years, and he had the Heckler, which is, you know, sort of like the Chicago Onion. It used to be in print, and at one point had something like 60,000 subscribers or like prints for every edition. Now it's just a website. But he knew people in town. And so I grew up in a suburb. I never lived in Chicago other than the 7 months right after college before I moved to L.A. So I was in L.A. for the first 6 years of, like, being an adult. So I came back for my first sports job, and I knew all the teams and the general media, but I didn't know anybody. I didn't know any of the people that worked anywhere. I had no connections to anyone. So I actually met him at a Blackhawks charity event that I was covering for Mouthpiece Sports, and he was there via connections to, like, the Heckler or StubHub or something. And so when we started dating, he actually knew a lot of people around town that I, you know, Rick Tellender, who I know from high school because his daughter went to high school with me, had written one of the first stories about the Heckler in the Chicago Tribune. He was friends with all these WGN people and different newspaper writers because they had written about the Heckler, or he had written stuff about them or interviewed them. And so he was super helpful in helping me feel more comfortable and getting to know the people around town that I needed to know. And then also his connection to sports means that we can do a lot of things together when we have free time that I would want to do anyway. I dated people before him that weren't sports fans, and I was always like, oh, it's not the end of the world. But the way my life is now, it'd be really hard to be with someone that wasn't in wanting to go to Blackhawks and Bulls and Cubs and everything else and talk about it. We don't debate sports at all. We do not sit at home and fight over you Darvish's contract or something. but he's like one of the people I mentioned earlier who was watching sports from a very young age with his dad and his grandpa, every detail. He can remember some foul ball he caught at the Brewers game when he was seven and who hit it. He can remember, and I don't have that. I didn't grow up with that. I can remember the couple games I went to. I went to one when I was 16. I went to one with my friend. Like, I can remember the very few moments of sports that my life was connected to with my parents growing up, but there were so few, like, they weren't into it. So he remembers, I'll sometimes be writing a story and I'll, like, yell in the other room. I'm like, all right, I need an 80s baseball player that was known for flying off the handle. And he'll, like, yell a name in. I'll Google it. I'm like, perfect. Because I'll be like, this is the analogy I want to make, but I can't come up with the name. And that's another thing when I started. I did not want to do radio because I thought people would call in and be like, who had the most home runs in 1989? And I'd be like, well, I don't know. Or they'd be like, what happened? And then I'd be like, I don't know. And I realized later that there are people who are that person.
For sure.
And there are people that are me. And sometimes the people who know all that stuff are not interesting. And I haven't had an interesting life and done interesting things.
Facts.
And did a bunch of other stuff before I ever got to sports that I think actually makes me have interesting insight into sports, because I didn't just grow up listening to sports radio my whole life, knowing that's what I wanted to do and cultivating zero other aspects of myself. Now, some people who have done that are fantastic at what they do. But there are others that just because you can pull stats out of your ass doesn't mean you make them interesting for anyone to listen to. And so when I stopped putting so much pressure on myself to have to be that plus who I am, it just got a lot easier. And so I just accept that, you know, I'm going to know a whole bunch of stuff that my husband doesn't know. He's going to know a whole bunch of stuff that I don't know. And we enjoy meeting in the middle on some stuff.
How do you handle being a role model for a new generation of personality?
I really love hearing from especially dads with daughters that are like, I have my daughter listening to your podcast or reading your stuff or whatever. Or even hearing from the girls themselves. A couple times there's a teacher who must be a fan of mine because I don't know how else. I've gotten letters from a bunch of students from a class at New Trier, and it's all girls in the class that write me about what they want to do. I don't want to sound like a jerk. It's sort of effortless in that the things that I say, I mean. You know what I mean? Like,
you're not trying to do anything.
Yeah.
You're just being you.
Right.
And by being you, you offer them an alternative.
Right.
Is that fair?
Yes, for sure. Yes. And that, like I said before, it was sort of a choice to decide that I wanted to talk about things that I think are meaningful in the industry. And it sort of wasn't a choice because it would have been so disingenuous for me to continue to play along with stuff that I disagreed with that I couldn't have really done it very well. You know, even just silly stuff like turning my mic on and reminding the guys when they say someone throws like a girl, oh, Jenny Finch, right? Or, you know, if their only conversation about women is either she's hot or she's lost her fastball, right? That often is when women come up for anything. So being around that, it's my natural way to just gently, even my own co-host Jason, who's awesome and totally forward thinking on stuff, his brain works so that when he makes an analogy, he always says hockey guy or baseball guy, right? His imaginary person is always this guy, hockey guy. So after he said it a bunch of times with, well, you know, baseball guy is always going to care about the way the game's played, whatever. I was like, I'm worried that your imaginary land full of people is going to die off because there's no women
just
there.
Guys.
There's no one to procreate with. And he was like, all right, I get your point. And I was like, just, you know, every once in a while you could hockey gal, or right?
No, that's
and
fair. I never thought about it until you just said it.
And he's like, well, usually I'm saying that they're an idiot and there's just more of us. I'm like, that's true. But we do have idiotic women listening and they want to be represented. No, but just stuff like that, that's so simple that if you are someone who's like, PC is dumb, like you hate to hear something as simple as that. And if you're not, you're like, that's a simple thing that when I was listening to sports radio for almost my whole life, I did not feel invited.
Hmm.
If you are never mentioned, unless it's about whether you're hot or not, and by you, I mean just women in general, then you don't feel like you're invited. So it's a simple thing to just say, all the guys and gals out there that are super into the Cubs, great news, instead of all you guys out there. It's just so easy. Why not do it? And so stuff like that that's so simple, or moments that are so simple like that, that comes naturally to me, and I know they annoy some people, but I would rather have people who are listening and show that to their daughter or moms and daughters who bond over that, have it make a difference for them growing up, because the guy who's really pissed that I just said that is probably not going to ever change, and they're probably not going to like me much anyway. You know what I mean? So, like, if I lose that extreme that doesn't even think I should be working in the business because I'm a woman.
That's not that terrible.
It's not that big of a loss. I would much rather feel like there's – and I've had girls write me that are like, I want to do what you're doing. And I'm like, oh, my God, if there had been a me or any number of – there's so many more women now. But if there had been us when I was growing up, maybe I would have thought, oh, my God, I could interview Michael Jordan. I could – you know what I'm saying? Like, I could work for the Bulls. And my whole life would have been different.
One more thing. What was it like to win the Peabody?
Surreal. Like, I have to say that Brad Burke, who was the guy who came up with the concept, like, I think of him as, like, the real winner, and then I think, like, just auxiliary, like, smaller trophies nearby.
You had to sit there.
But it was our story.
Jeez.
And it was our insight that helped put it together, too, when we got there and talking with him about what he should include and stuff like that. But, it felt like I was a part of something bigger because it was me too. It was Leslie Jones on Twitter. It was us doing that. It was Lindy West on NPR talking about her trolls. It was this movement of standing up and saying this is how it is and it can't be this way anymore, and being recognized for that. I think there's so much more that needs to be done in practical every day. But it starts with people who matter recognizing a problem, validating it, and then everybody else around trying to help. And that, I think, that particular More Than Mean piece, a lot of people who were already sympathetic and on our side didn't really get it until they saw it. And unfortunately, part of that was that it was the men getting emotional. And we sometimes don't want to listen to women when they say, this is what's happening to me. But instead of us saying it, it was men that became emotional about it. And watching their vulnerability, I think, moved people in a way that if Julie and I had just sat up there and said, this is what we're getting said to us, it makes us sad, people wouldn't have reacted the same. And so that's both unfortunate, but also part of the reason why it worked. So a lot of people then after that were like, okay, we get it now. It's much more serious than we ever thought.
Thank you for this. This was exactly, like, I thought this would be great, and I was not disappointed at all. So thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
How fun was that? I had a wonderful time talking with Sarah Spain, and it was cool. Like, it was a good vibe in the studio, and we just got to kind of hang out and talk about the business. And I don't know why, but I wasn't expecting her to say Eddie Murphy. I don't know why. Maybe that's some profiling on my part that I was expecting her to say, like, Chris Farley or I don't know. I was shocked that was her go-to, but I completely get it. I totally understand it, and I think that it's great that was her choice for Saturday Night Live character. I also think there were some really important stuff about how to communicate displeasure with things that you are seeing in front of you, how to go about it, how to develop your own voice, and then use that voice for good. I'm really glad that she agreed to do it, that she was willing to even take it to the higher ups at ESPN to see if they would allow it. And I'm so happy that we got the chance to talk because she was on the hit list. She was on the list of people that I really wanted to have on the podcast. So shout out to her. She does a tremendous job with everything she does over at ESPN. She's just a lot of fun to talk with and has a lot to say, which is appreciated. I know the podcast is going a little longer than usual, but the conversation with Sarah was so good, I just kept it rolling. But I did promise you emails, and here are your emails. You can email the podcast at houseoflpodcast@gmail.com. Let's take a look here. And this is what I was talking about at the beginning of the podcast. It's from Matt. He says, for years, the Score lineup has gone through changes. You're one of, if not the best hosts at the station. I always wonder why you haven't gotten on one of the standard time slots. Is it because you prefer the freedom of the nights allows you, as I know you have a lot of stuff going on? Thanks, that's from Matt. Here's the thing. Yes, I do enjoy the freedom of doing the nighttime show, that it allows me to do other things. But I will say that those things developed as a byproduct of my schedule, that because I was on at night and because I felt like there was other stuff that I could do, that I branched out. And I've been given a lot of opportunity to branch out early on in my career. Contractually, that didn't have to be allowed, but Mitch Rosen allowed me to do it. And I appreciate him for that. I'll always appreciate him for that. Now I have some of that stuff written into my contract that I can do other things and do other stuff. I push back a little bit about the idea of the standard time slot. And I'm using air quotes right now. I've always been bothered by people who think my career is somehow lesser because I'm on at night. I don't think it's fair to me, and I don't think it's fair to the people who produce and work on my show. I take a lot of pride in the fact that people who've worked on my show, just about every executive producer that I've had since I've been at the Score, has been promoted, and they've gotten what is maybe an easier time slot just because the way the world works. But I take a lot of pride in the fact that we're asked to do more with less at night. We don't have the type of funding that other shows have. A lot of times over the last few years, it's gone down to just one producer, one full-time producer. Now that's Herb Lawrence, but it used to be Joe Ostrowski for a long time. And seeing those guys grow and develop is a lot of fun. If the right opportunity came along, I would take it. But there haven't been those right opportunities for me to move up. And honestly, one of the things I wonder about now is whether or not I even want a partner. And I've struggled with that for a really long time. And if you go back and listen to the episode with Dan Zampillo, you can hear us kind of joking about that. It might be a failing in my own personality. I'm not sure. But I know that I can always depend on me. And I'd rather not depend on someone else and then be let down if they don't live up to what are sometimes my ridiculous standards about how the business goes and that sort of thing. But I do take some offense to the idea that the nighttime show is lesser. And again, maybe that's a failing in me too. But we try to do creative stuff, and my bosses have given me a lot of freedom, not just to do other things, but to do a show that is different than traditional, what you would call drive time. By the way, drive time in radio still goes through 7 p.m. And my 6 o'clock hour is usually very highly rated. And it's something that I take a lot of pride in, that people that are driving home at 6 o'clock will listen to the show. So I appreciate the question, Matt. I get asked it more, and I'm not trying to take it out on you, Matt, but I get asked it a lot, and it's sometimes bothersome when I don't feel like the show that I do gets enough respect. It is what it is, and I'm always looking for opportunities to better and challenge myself. And that's why I've been doing a lot of TV. It's one of the reasons why I branched out and wanted to do a podcast. But the nighttime show for me right now is where it's at. One more thing on this. I did a 7-week stint hosting the midday show with Spiegel when Mac had gone away. And after that 7 weeks was up, I went back, and Joe Ostrowski was EP of the nighttime show, and I was like, I won't leave here again. I didn't like having to come back and almost restart the nighttime show. So I'll fill in occasionally on other shows, but I don't want long tenures on other shows unless it's a full-time tenure on it, unless my name is actually on the show. I don't want to do that because I don't think it's fair to the listener that tunes in at 6 o'clock for me to be there and I'm not there outside of our play-by-play obligations. I don't think that that's fair to do to the listener. And after that 7 weeks, I felt pretty crappy about doing that to the nighttime show, because they had rotating hosts for those 7 weeks that I was doing middays. That's tough on producers. I think that's tough on the listener. You get into your routine, and then it's just totally turned upside down. I didn't know when I was going to go back to the nighttime show. They didn't know when I was going to go back to the nighttime show. So I would prefer that, unless there's some sort of dire emergency, that I stay where I'm at until a time comes where my name goes on a show in another time slot. Fair? Okay. How about this one from Ryan? Ryan says, Lawrence, loving the podcast. Lynn was great. Brings back my many personal memories from my brief stint as a promotions intern at XRT in the summer of 99. I would love to see if you can land Paula Ferris. That would be amazing. Would love to hear Sports Sunday stories and just get her perspective on Chicago sports since she's all national now. This one is probably too soon, but Brian Hanley would be a great guest too. I'm sure dust needs to settle first, but his goodbye a couple weeks ago really got to me. Would you ever consider Jay Hood or anyone across the dial, or is that an ESPN thing where you won't allow them to? Looking forward to future podcasts. From Ryan. See, Ryan, if you made it through this podcast, you already know the answer to the question. There are a lot of people across the aisle that I have a good relationship. And next week you'll hear another one. Not that it's technically 1,000, but it's another ESPN person. And you'll be able to hear that. But Jeff Dickerson was on my list of people that I wanted to get on the podcast, but he's been going through some stuff, which he's been transparent about, and I'm not here to speak about his business. But he's someone that I absolutely adore, and I would love to have him on. I'd love to have Jonathan on. I'm trying to figure out which will happen first, whether Jonathan's on my podcast or I'm on Jonathan's podcast. The Under the Hood podcast is also really good. You should check it out. He gets a lot of cool guests on, and I check it out, and I'm like, fuck. Did I just say that on the podcast? I did. Sarah already cursed, so this one I can just be dirty. There are a lot of people he'll get that I'm like, man, I really wanted that person. Like, I want to sit down with Scoop, and Jonathan's already had him on the podcast. But there's so much I want to talk to Scoop about. Anyway, yes, that is definitely on the list. I would love to have Brian on the podcast for a lot of different reasons. And he knows that. He's actually a listener of the podcast. And one of the things he told me before he left is how much he liked The House of L, which meant a lot to me because when I started out, when I was a producer, I was cocky. And Brian was one of the people that kind of said, you need to do a better job of getting your point across. You need to change tone. You have good ideas, but you need to do a better job of getting them across. And that I hadn't earned some of the arrogance that I was walking around the station with. So I've always appreciated Brian for that. As I said in the tweet, he put me on the right path. And I will be forever grateful for him, to him for that. So, yes, he is always welcome on this podcast. And even if he just wants to talk about the 90s, I would be down for an hour of Brian Hanley. As far as Paula Faris goes, that's a really interesting suggestion. We had a lot of fun, and Paula was instrumental. Her and Peggy Kaczynski were instrumental in my transition from radio to television. They basically were like, when I got to Channel 5, I had been doing a segment where I was teaching Zoraida Sambolin about football on Sunday mornings. Like, that was the segment. And I actually thought it was pretty good. Like, we had a lot of fun. It was a 5-minute segment or whatever. And I thought it was dope. And then they were like, can you read a teleprompter? And I'm like, sure, I can read a teleprompter. But it was Peggy and Paula who went out of their way to help me make that transition easier. Paula's one of my favorite people. We joke about her running for office someday because I think that she'd be an incredible candidate. And I told her that I would love to be on her campaign when she runs. So, yeah, she's on the list. So is Rebecca Harlow. Rebecca and I probably, no diss to anyone else, because I loved working with Mike Adamly when I was over at Channel 5. Rebecca and I probably had the best time working together on Sports Sunday. So she's on the list, but with her being the sideline reporter for the Knicks, like trying to match up her schedule to get her in studio is really difficult. If worse comes to worse, I'm going to get her on the phone and we're going to have a good time. So yeah, hopefully that answers all your questions, Ryan. Look at me being all long-winded and whatnot. Surprise, surprise, surprise. I guess I got to put the explicit thing on this week's podcast too, huh? Well, that'll do it for me. Thanks for listening. Next week's guest, I can tell you I've already done the interview, and I think you're going to really enjoy it. Thanks to everyone who listened to this week's episode. Shout out to Sarah Spain. Tremendous guest with a lot of perspective. Glad that we were able to connect and make it work. Shout out to Heckler Brad, her husband. It's a good man right there. Real good man. Thanks for listening this week. Next week, we get it cracking again. I appreciate the support. If you want to email us, houseoflpodcast@gmail.com. Have a great week.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.